Hey folks, John Suntress here, welcoming you back to another edition of Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show in association with Newsarama. On today's episode, writer Brian Wood previews Thursday's release of Northlander 17. With art from Vasilis Lolos and Dave McCaig, Wood weaves the elements of a fierce blood match, a History Channel-style commentary of weaponry and Viking warriors, and a plain-speaking narrative that showcases the adventure behind epic poetry. The result is an excellent one-shot that defines the qualities of the series and allows the curious to jump in on its unique excitement. We'll be talking about the series and its background with Brian, plus we'll be discussing his other great series from Vertigo, DMZ, life in Manhattan during a civil war that takes place all over the country of the United States. We also take some questions from our Word Balloon listeners and talk about some of Brian's past works, including Demo with Becky Cloonan, Volume 2, soon to be released from Vertigo Comics, Local with Ryan Kelly, and we reach back to series like The Couriers and Channel Zero. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where you'll find a wide variety of original graphic novels, trade paperbacks, hardcovers, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials, all at savings of up to 35% off the cover price, with orders of $50 or more receiving free shipping. Featured at InStockTrades.com, you can find plenty of books with the name Brian Wood on the cover. How about Supermarket, the trade paperback? The standard retail price for Supermarket is $14.99 at InStockTrades.com, just $10.49. What about Volume 1 of Northlanders or Volume 1 of DMC? Both retail for $9.99 at InStockTrades.com. You can receive each of them for just $6.29. How about the hardcover edition of Local from Oni Press? A great collection of 12 issues between Brian and Ryan Kelly. The standard retail price, $29.99 at InStockTrades.com, just $20.99. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com. For all your pre-order monthly needs, you can track your orders online. There are monthly specials up to 75% off, and don't forget you get savings of 40% off the major publishers. For all the details, check out the websites, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com.
What the story is, basically, is it's an overview of as many aspects of like Viking Age warfare as I could fit into a 22-page sword fight, basically. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to have that sort of like, I wanted to like slow this sword fight down, you know, to make it last an entire issue and give it that sort of like kinetic vagabond style, you know, manga kind of a feel, you know, which is why I hooked up with Vasilis there, because I know he's a fan of that book. And so, like, in these moments where the sword fight slows down to, like the seconds crawl by, I just wanted to, like, that's where I was going to load in all this, like, you know, technical info about how the Vikings fought. But then I also obviously needed a story there. This is kind of one of those things where I love working in the comics, because you can't really do this in any other format, you know? It would just be like a mess. I mean, I sort of have like several different things going on here, and I really feel like comics is the only way I could have done this particular thing. So there's a story of these two guys that are kind of duking it out on behalf of their respective clans or their lords. I guess that's where that brawl stuff comes in that you like, you know, these two champions, you know,
you needed like a 10th century, like Howard Cosell, you know, this fine warrior.
Yeah. Right. I'll save that for the movie.
You know, well, and the other thing too is it you're right. The comic book is the perfect format for something like this, but I could almost see, a future kind of thing where there's almost like pop-up text involved as this battle is going on, where you do get all this backstory, and I kind of see it as kind of, on the one hand, almost a flash video, and I don't mean to demean the art.
I'm sure it could also, I'm sure there's a way it could work. I guess you really, I don't know. That sort of, I'm sure it could work a certain way. I don't know if it could work exactly the way I got had it here. If anybody's read that Warren Ellis, I always forget how to pronounce that, but Kreshi, you know, that graphic novella he did?
No, I don't
about
actually.
About that, it was an Avatar book that was sort of an examination of an English battle, like the first battle where archers were deployed on the battlefield against the French.
Oh, wow.
It came out a couple years ago. It kind of has that same sort of, I mean, I'm not doing it justice by saying, you know, an encyclopedic look, but it definitely, like, breaks down all the battle tactics in not the same way I do it, but in a similar way. So I'm sure if anybody's listening to this and have read that, they now know exactly what I'm getting at here.
Well, I think it is an interesting story on so many levels, and the information that you provide as well. And it is, on the one hand, it's a play-by-play. There's also this commentary that's going on. And, and then you've got the battle itself as well. And also just the plight of, you kind of go through the plight of a warrior and the different motivations that might lead to this kind of fight if it was another person. And you go through the various, types of life that,
right,
an average man might have in this period, from berserker to farmhand and serf, et cetera.
Yeah, and also sort of like the unglamorous look of it, too. I mean,
yes,
at first it's these two badasses, and they're out there, doing what they do. But, as it goes on, it's sort of like, maybe it's not so great to be on the receiving end of this when the Vikings come and invade your home.
You Absolutely.
Know, kill your kids. Take your wife with you, or with them, So I kind of try to, like, towards the end, try to flip it around, it's all well and good to be a Viking until someone comes Viking in your neighborhood,
Yeah, and also the embarrassment that some of these guys, the henchmen or the tribesmen have to do to kind of, make the Lord's wishes happen, and I like that comment too, where, as they're running around pillaging, there's a bunch of hordes guys, they're raping all the women, they're killing the children.
Yeah.
It is the full tapestry of what happens when the Vikings come to attack and just battle in general. I love it.
I really it's no secret that I do a lot of research for this book, and with this issue I kind of reached that glorious tipping point where I've done I over research. I mean, it's like a sickness with me. But at this issue, I reached the tipping point where I stopped having to, like, find things in books, where I just, like, knew it, which is a little scary in a way. Like, too much of my brain is being used to hold all this information. Where I just kind of came out, I referred to books a couple times because I had to find out, like the weight of swords and everything. I have all that kind of specs. Length and weight of swords and shields, but other than that, it's just sort of like this subject matter is so deep in my brain, it's a little scary. and this issue here is like the perfect example of that. So anyways, it's a great jumping on point. It's kind of why I did it at this point. We just got finished doing the arc that is going to be volume 2.
Mm-hmm.
Of the trade, so there's this one here, which is like a single issue, and I've really been telling everybody and retailers and everything how, like, I could not have made a better kind of sample issue, a better jumping on point. I don't want to call it jumping on point because it's a done in one, but I mean, it's like if anybody like hasn't read the book or did at the beginning and got bored or something, this is really a great way to, like, check it out again.
I agree, and I think it is. It's, as you say, it's a self-contained story, and I also like the fact that what I've liked from the beginning of the series is that you tell this history in a very plain language. And
yeah.
And there's, it's interesting, though, because I would say on the one hand, it is simple to, simple to read. And I think you know what I mean. It's straightforward. There is a lyric quality to it as well that I find interesting that you're able to weave the two together. And I think in a one doesn't overpower the other. So, I mean, there's, at face value, there's a very good story here. There's also some beautiful words here as well. But you're not going to feel like you're in the wrong, movie. That one idea isn't overcrowding the other. And I think that's
right.
Cool.
Well, thank you. No, it's definitely, I really... I mean, especially at this point, like, I've been writing it for a couple of years. I've kind of, like, I've kind of figured that formula out, at least as far as like how I want to do it. I'm not saying this is the only way, obviously, to write a Viking book, but like I've sort of like gotten that sort of cadence down a bit, and especially with this, and like the next few issues are either more standalones or like two-parters, and they kind of like jump all over the place. So I've sort of like been able to write and kind of like different voices and kind of radically different contexts. Like the next one is about it's about wives of slain Vikings.
Okay.
And it's all about them from their point of view, and that was like kind of a phenomenal undertaking in a way, because there's no real. I mean, who really knows what like a Viking wife thought about? Because they're just like they weren't like considered really. I read the sagas, which is really kind of the only way to find out. And those things, I mean, it's a history, but it's like a poem. It's a story. Like nothing. There's no way to know if any of that is actually what happened. You know, it was all written hundreds of years after the fact. So, I mean, I kind of read that, but it's like, I mean, I know I'm reading a poem, you know? So, and, you know, these poets were, like, paid at the time to, like, over-embellish everything, you know, to make, like, the stories grander and better and the victories cooler and everything.
Sure.
So I'm like, so I really had to sort of, like, you know, I read a lot of books, but really it was just sort of, like winging it, you know? I didn't want to, like, you know, trivialize everything. I didn't want to make them just wives. I mean, I know that this was a time when women weren't particularly, you know, free to do anything, you know. So I sort of had to, like, tell that without being a chauvinist about it, not being stereotypical. I don't want them to be, like, you know, I don't want to flip the other way to, like, an extreme and have them be, like, these badass warriors, you know, because they weren't, you know. I don't know. So it was, like, this, like, deft line walking I had to make with, like, a lot of, like, guesswork and sweating and hoping I don't offend anybody and everything. Yeah, so that's like a two-parter coming up. But yeah, so that's like, I mean, that's kind of like approaching the book from like a new angle. You know, here I am at issue 18, you know, kind of like doing that, which is kind of why I really love writing this book. Because every time I start a new arc or whatever, I can really just like start over again, you know. I'm not locked into a certain character or time, place, or anything. So it's a lot of fun to write, and I really feel like you know, as time goes on, it becomes that much richer a book, you know.
Well, and I think you started flirting with that kind of idea when you were writing Demo, it seems.
Yeah, this is really just Demo expanded out. Instead of doing like instead of doing self-contained single issues with Demo. Is a self-contained arcs, you know, that really do start brand new each time.
And yeah, so that's interesting because some people might even be like, "Oh shit, what am I going to do next?" But it, obviously, for you, it's the ideas aren't the challenge. It, you know,
well, no, it's a challenge.
Okay,
it's a challenge. It really is because you really like I was twittering online just now because for this upcoming Northlanders arc, that's issues 21 to 28, I had to write this huge outline for it because I really am beginning a new project. I mean, I kind of am. You know?
Sure.
I mean, it's still called Northlanders, but everything is new, you know. So each time I do that, I have to, like, basically think like it's a brand new book. I can't build on what I've already written like I can with DNC. And it's not easy. It's definitely not, and I just like thank my lucky stars that I have the ideas, you know.
Sure.
Like I have enough. I can come up with like enough ideas. I can burn through them and like use them once and get rid of them, you know. I guess I should knock on wood, but that keeps up. And I'm also writing more Demo now at the same time, so it's kind of the same thing, you know, coming up with brand new stories every month.
When does Volume 2 of Demo hit the atmosphere?
I don't know. It's not scheduled yet.
Okay.
I think we got off to like kind of a slow start, so I think they're just waiting to. Yeah, I think we're probably gonna have to get four issues done before they put it on the schedule. And
that's
cool. We're working on issue three now. Becky's drawing issue three.
Okay.
So I mean, my best guess, and it's not, I mean, take it for the grain of salt, it's probably going to be like January.
Okay.
Because I think they've already scheduled out their books through like November. I don't know. Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Very cool. Well, back to Northlanders, because I wanted to ask about the other thing that I like. I wouldn't think that I would have enjoyed, you know, reading about the weapons and even the boats, because on the one hand, you feel like, you know, this is just old stuff, and especially right now when we're in this technology shift and right. things are changing, and really the information age is making advancements seem that much faster and stuff. And then, actually, I was amazed at some of the information, like the talk of the, it's not longbow, what are the boats called? That
long ships.
Yeah. I mean, those are amazing. And
they really are. I'm actually going to Norway next week, and I'll get to go to that famous museum where they have all those, like, full boats they dug out of the ground.
And again, this shallow, long boat that would, you know, have 40 men and be able to travel, like, quietly, it's essentially a stealth boat.
Well, the real yeah, it is. And the real crazy thing about these boats is, I mean, I see pictures of them, like recreations or whatever.
Sure.
And they're not that big. And I had to, like, double-check all my info because I couldn't believe it. They would fit 50 or 60 men on this thing that looked like it was as big as, like, a mobile home, you know? And they would, like, sail for, like, weeks. And I'm like, where do they sleep? You know, where do they put all their food? Like, it was, like, crazy. But they really did have crews that big. And on some of, like, the bigger boats, they actually carried the horses on them.
Jesus.
Which actually I have a really hard time imagining. But yeah, they were like basically like these like shallow bowls in the water that you know, were somehow stable in waves. And yeah, I mean, the great thing about, I mean, I think that's kind of what made Vikings is their ability to like basically sail up rivers, you know, and creeks even. I mean, like I said in the book, they only needed like a foot and a half of water, you know. And
that's
so they could, like, you know, you think your, like, coast is defended, and the next thing you know, these boats are sailing up the river, you know, attacking your home. You know, it's, like, scary, and they put those dragon heads on the boats for that reason, you know, just to spook you.
That's really cool.
It's very, very cool. It's one of the, I think it's actually one of the coolest things about Vikings are these boats. Yeah, and they buried you in them, too, if you're rich enough.
Is there a, like, one specific Norse poet like Homer was for the Greeks? And even now, I guess there's speculation that Homer might have even been, you know, for lack of better terms, a pen name. You know, maybe a couple people wrote as Homer. Maybe the Odyssey and the Iliad were not written by the same person. But is there that kind of noteworthy Norse poet that has all this information?
There's a few. I mean, there's a lot of sagas. There's definitely some that wrote more than others. And, of course, now, you know, you put, anytime anybody puts me on the spot, I always, like, have a hard time pronouncing all their names. but the, God, I'm totally going to go look at my bookshelf. There's the Iceland sagas. There's, like, a bunch of them that are generally published under that title.
Okay.
They're not usually credited on the books. But I actually named one of the characters in issue 17 after one of the famous ones, Snorri.
Okay, yeah.
Snorri. He's, I think Tolkien actually named one of the dwarves after him in Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit, because Tolkien was a big fan of these things, too.
I can see that.
And I think a lot of the dwarves have names of saga poets, and Snorri is one of the bigger ones. And there's some other ones. I don't know. That's the biggest one.
Okay.
No, some
that's
of them are
really
written,
cool.
Like, I'm looking at this book, the Orkney sagas are written by, like, an unknown author. So I'm sure there are things that, you know, were either lost and then found and didn't know who the writers were. But they're not always very easy things to read, I have to say.
Sure.
I, like, slog through them, and they're pretty tough. It's like reading Beowulf or something.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I know what you mean. Yes.
Yeah, but they're pretty fascinating, especially if you, you know, I always find reading about them, even though it's kind of a cop out, reading about them is a lot more interesting than actually reading them. You know. Because then you have somebody put it in context and do all the hard work for you.
These are scholars that are kind of writing their opinions on the
Yeah, course. Or they just kind of translate. It's like when you're in high school and like that one great English teacher explains actually what's happening in Shakespeare, and you're like, oh my God, really? Oh, cool. You know, you're like, wow, that's like a great story. You know, it's kind of like that. Though I will say I read. I probably read about 80% of the sagas for this book, so I definitely paid my dues.
Well, I think the only fair thing, then, is you need your own, like, Viking show now on the History Channel.
Oh, yeah.
Do you watch those things?
I do.
All right, cool, because like a week or two ago I was watching one. So I think they are interesting, again, and you don't appreciate the similarities until it is put in the correct context, as you say, in the case of a teacher, or even, you know, when they are able to make entertaining television and tell these very interesting stories. I agree.
I always like when the hosts go to, you know, somewhere in Europe, and then there's, like, the real scholar, you know? Like,
sure.
Always the host is the host, but then they find some, like, you know, Danish dude, you know, who's, like, his life work is, like, building these boats or something. And they actually look like Vikings, you know. So I always find that pretty cool. Because then you're like looking at these people, and you're like, you know, you can trace your family history straight back. I bet. Yeah. Cool.
Have you met any weapon makers, or you know, any?
No, not really. I mean, I went to Iceland on my honeymoon around the time I was first kind of launching this book.
Okay.
And like I tried on like chainmail shirts and stuff, so I can appreciate how much of those things weigh. You know, like I put in that issue. They're phenomenally heavy. You know, the real ones are.
Sure.
And, you know, and I picked up shields and swords, but I never actually went anywhere where they were made or anything.
Okay.
Sorry about that background.
Oh, no worries. No, hey, man, that's audio verte. Don't even.
Yeah. Living in Brooklyn.
There you go, man. In the DMZ, man.
Yeah, true.
and I enjoyed that, and it was interesting to your whole assessment of chainmail and how, you know, a person today would think it's protection, but I like how the warrior was kind of, you know, made fun of for it and everything, that it's like, you know, especially given that it was a little too long and that it was basically sissy clothes.
Right.
Can't be. You're not a cool warrior if you're wearing chainmail.
No, poor guy. Yeah, his chainmail was too big. they wore those things all the time. That was always that was the other thing I found very, very cool. And it makes total sense. I mean, if you have to wear a shirt that weighs like 120 pounds into battle, you know, you might as well wear it all the time and get used to it. You know?
Absolutely.
Although I can't even imagine. I mean, they wore them on ships. I'm sure not every day they were on a ship, like if they were taking a long trip. But if they were like on their way to attack someplace, they had to wear those things. And if you fall into the water, you're just done. You know, that 100 pound shirt is going to pin you to the ocean floor. You know,
wow,
you're not going to swim out of that.
Yeah,
which is pretty rough. You know.
No, that was amazing. And again, it's everything, man. I mean, that's the thing. The weapons that you can dismiss as being nothing, but in the right context of battle, can prove to be the weapons that count, and I think we see that in a lot of the pages in the story as well.
Right, yeah.
I want to transition because I had some Word Balloon fans wanted to write in and ask you some questions.
Yes, I think I stumbled across that.
My thanks to Zorn.
I didn't read them all, though.
Zorn, this one fan in particular, got the ball rolling and was the guy's like, hey, man, when are you going to have Wood on for Word Balloon? And I'm like, hey, you know, you're right. So I'm glad he contacted us and made the love connection happen.
Yeah,
but
cool.
Let's see here. We're going to start, and I believe he asks the first question, doesn't he? No, he does not. Excuse me. But I will go to Spank Everest from Melbourne, Australia.
Okay.
The words of your stories are so much like a character in their own right. Do you tend to plot out the character's world completely before working on the lead character, or do they both come to fruition together?
I think always the world kind of comes first. Like I wanted to write a Viking book. That came at first. I'm sure with DMZ, the first thing in my mind was like a war-torn, New York City. Trying to think if anything, with the local, it was the format of the book came before Megan. Trying to think if there's any times when the characters did come first. I'm sure in demo they did, because those are so heavily character focused things. But no, I think it's always the world, and I always like. I mean, I really spend a lot of time on that. Making sure it's like a specific and a credible place. Mm-hmm. Even when it's like a general place, I try to think about details first.
Jacob Pound from Tucson, Arizona. I love the kinetic energy the Couriers has. I do too. Do you have any plans to work with your artist again and the same artist again and return to the series?
Yes. That book is optioned for a film. I don't know if everybody knows that, but it was optioned a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And Rob G and I sort of have, like a general, we both agree that if it actually looks like they're actually going to start shooting a film, we should make a new book. But Rob G kind of like, he's not so heavy into comics these days. He still draws, but he does like, he does like a lot of video game work and
okay.
I'm sure other stuff. So I may have to force him into it. I don't know. Because I definitely want to revisit that book. And I love working with Rob. He's been a friend for years. And I feel like we'd be fools to not do a new Couriers book if there's a movie coming out.
Well, good luck with that. That'd be great.
When that happens, I don't know. I mean, there's a script. We both read the script for the film, and it's good. Last I heard, they didn't have a director attached yet.
So. Okay.
I think it's a ways off.
I understand. Mark for myself from Vermont.
Yeah.
First of all, he wants to know, being a Vermonter himself, he heard a rumor that you were from Vermont.
I am.
Whereabouts?
I'm very, very proud of it. Right outside of Burlington in Essex.
Very cool. I loved local and was surprised at how much I love Northlanders as well. I'm curious as to who your influences are, what some of your favorite creators were growing up, any favorite titles or stories, and also any movie and music recommendations you'd like to toss out. Well, let's start with creator influences first.
One of the things I feel like sets me apart from most of my peers is that I didn't read comics when I was a kid. I didn't actually, I mean, I'm sure, I shouldn't say that. I'm sure I did like read comics once in a while when I was a kid, but I wasn't really into them. I didn't like follow them. The fact that I can't actually think back to any comics I read when I was a kid kind of tells you how much I was into them. I didn't really get into them until college, which may kind of go some ways towards explaining why I don't really work on the company books.
Sure.
Like I do creator owned stuff and indie stuff first, because that's kind of what I. That was my first introduction to comics. Actually, I think the book Hate, that Peter Bagg book Hate, was
sure.
The first book I actually followed. Like I read and bought every month.
That's cool.
Yeah, and so like I mean, Hate was like a big influence on me. I don't.
Did you have a friend then that got you into comics? I mean, what?
My cousin. This is actually kind of a story that's going to, I'm sure it's going to make a lot of you out there think I'm a complete idiot, and I was. My cousin, who was much older than me, for some reason I can't recall, basically gave me his entire comic book collection. I knew nothing about it. I was like 18 years old. I knew nothing about this. All I knew, there was like seven or eight long boxes, and I remember like looking through, and I think I read a couple of Watchmen's out of it.
Okay.
And but then I was moving to New York for college, and I'm like, well, I can't move all these books, and so I think I sold them all to somebody for $20, not actually really knowing I didn't have any idea, right? I didn't even understand what DC or Marvel was.
I understand.
I had, like, zero idea at all. And I'm sure, like, some dude out there was, like, laughing all the way to the bank with that. it's an embarrassing story.
What year was this? What, around what year was this?
91.
Okay.
Something like that. It's a real shame.
So like seven long boxes for $20.
Or something. I don't even know how much it was. It was like a lot of books, and I'm sure it was like. And my cousin was like pretty into it, as I recall. So I'm sure there were some real little gems in there. So yeah, every so often I think back to that, and I'm like, man, you know, whatever. You can't beat yourself up over it, but you know.
Well then, so what led to you actually reading a book?
I was in art school. And I knew about Dave McKean and Kent Williams because I knew of their work on record covers.
Okay.
Magazines. Like, I remember I actually bought that Alice Cooper record that Dave McKean did the art for.
Very cool.
And so, like, I knew about these people because I, you know, book covers and whatnot in school. And then someone told me they did comic books, and I really couldn't imagine how that could be true, because I'm thinking back to like the Richie Riches or whatever I read when I was five, and I'm like, there's no way these people make these comic books. And so I went to like a comic book store, and that's when I saw like Vertigo. This was in like 94, I think, so it was all like the Sandman covers and everything.
Sure.
So then I was like, wow, like in my typical like art snob phase, as I like to say, you know, I was like, wow, these are art. You know, like a snob. So I just began buying it, and then I sort of like, you know, at that point I was like kind of hooked, and then retroactively went back and read all the books that I'm sure I sold out of those seven long boxes. You know, I had to go and re-buy all that stuff. So that was kind of it. So I kind of have like had a crash course, you know, catching up basically. So as far as like influences in comics, I mean, I was really into Frank Miller because all that was new. Like, I was reading Dark Knight Returns and Daredevil and Sin City basically all at the same time,
because
I was trying to catch up, you know. And you know, like a lot of my art at the time, because I went to art school and I wanted to draw comics first before I wrote them. You know, like writing comics wasn't even anything in my mind at that time. So I was like really like aping Frank Miller style, like everybody has done at some point in their lives. you know, Warren Atlas was an influence big, and he was like a big helper of mine, a big you know, promoter of me early on. And I remember being really, I think around the time Channel Zero came out, was right around the time he was doing Transmet. And I think his Wildstorm books were beginning around then. So yeah, I thought those were pretty cool. But then I was reading a lot of indie stuff like Peter Bagg, and you know catching up on all the older stuff like Love and Rockets.
Very cool.
So yeah, there was like this intensive period of time from like probably 93-94 to like, you know, 98 when I actually began making my own, where I was just reading anything I could find.
That's really cool. You know, that is one of the more like satisfying moments I have, is when I take a non-comics fan into either a regular bookstore every now and then can convince one to walk into a cool comic book store and get to the indie section and open it up and go, see, this is comics too.
Yeah.
And just that like stun, and I had no idea. And it does. It's cool. And it you know, legitimizes the medium in the non-fan's eyes. And in some cases it has turned them into readers, which I think is great. So, and God,
yeah, I mean,
your case turned into a new creator. That's even better.
Yeah, I'm the perfect example of that. Like, I was a complete snob. Like, I had zero idea. Like, I had all these preconceived notions about what they were, you know, and came in as an adult. And, you know, all it took was, like, an Alice Cooper record cover, I guess.
Well, how about it? And speaking of that, how about any music or movie recommendations for Mark?
God, ever since I had my kid, I've seen like three movies in the last couple of years. I just watch a lot of stuff on DVD, like a lot of TV shows. We're watching Dexter 3 right now.
Very cool.
Music, as I turn into like an old fart, I go backwards in time, and I'm reliving a lot of like really cheesy stuff that I remember growing up with. This is not gonna help anybody out at all. But I listen to like a lot of like folk music and Irish folk, which was the stuff the stuff that was like always in my ears as a kid, you know. But like favorites, I mean, I really like Sonic Youth. I'm just like a huge, huge fan for like 20 years of my life. I've been following them. They have a new record coming out, which is cool. See, this is the kind of question that my mind goes instantly blank. Like, who wrote the sagas, and even what kind of music do you listen to? Been listening to, let's see what I got. Recently played Arcade Fire, listened to that. The Decemberists have a new record out. Mm-hmm. The Kills, I see here. Ted Leo, which is like a big, another old favorite of mine. Yep. It's like a lot of like, you know, indie rock stuff like that. I used to be a big rap guy, but I've kind of, I don't really find a whole lot of new stuff I like. So again, I just go back to like the old stuff I loved.
Now Zorn, the guy who inspired this thread, has his questions.
Okay.
Considering Couscous Express and Couriers, are there plans for a complete collection a la demo or the beautiful local hardcover?
I doubt it'll be a local hardcover style. I'm pushing very, very hard for like a single volume of all that stuff. It's kind of up to AIT to do it or not. And the problem we always have is that, you know, one of the volumes falls out of print, you know, and we have plenty of the other two. So it's like, do we just like keep that volume out of print while we wait until everything's out of print in order to justify like a single volume, or what, you know, or do we like, you know, like take the financial hit and print the single volume now, and you know, while there's thousands of copies of the individuals in stock. So yeah, that's the one thing standing in our way. But it's definitely my intention as soon as I can to get a single volume of those. And I'm sure it'll be like one done on the cheap. I mean, just like a basic soft cover with like a low price tag.
Okay. He just wants to say that he thinks the local hardcover is the single most beautiful thing in my entire collection.
I agree. No, I'm super proud of that, and I can't take a single bit of credit for it. It was all like Oni Press's idea. They came up with it. I didn't have to ask for it. It was they did like an amazing, amazing job. And we're all thrilled about it. I mean, I'm sure, and I can't even imagine how much that must have cost to a print, you know. And I'm sure it's going to be a while before any of us are making any money off of it. But we really just felt like it was worth it, you know, to have such a great addition.
Excellent. I think in a future conversation we'll get more into local, because yeah, that, yep. Local and demo really were my two favorite series of yours, and made me take notice of you and keep watching for new stuff. And then of course Supermarket and all your current stuff now with DMC and Northlanders as well. Now, he says, you mentioned on Facebook you were writing a treatment for a mainstream or established book.
Yes.
What can you tell us about that?
Not really anything that I haven't already said. I mean, obviously, I'm exclusive to DC, so that narrows it down,
sure,
a bit in terms of where. The plan, I believe, we're trying to figure out if we want to announce this at the summer shows, like at San Diego.
Sure.
Myself and the artist are going to Baltimore Con, so maybe we should wait and do it then. It's like a smaller show.
Uh-huh.
Like news gets lost in the San Diego shuffle.
Absolutely.
So I mean, that's the conversation we're having now. I'm about halfway done writing it. This artist, who I'm not giving any clues to, is drawing these pages at a speed that I have not ever seen before. I'm actually like a little bit worried I'm going to be able to keep up. It's a bad sign when your artist is faster than you are. Yeah, so it's definitely like, you know, it's going really, really well. I'm actually worried because there's so much like, everybody's like wondering what it is, and they're talking about it online, and I really think everybody's gonna be kind of bummed. I feel like there's too much anticipation about it, because it's like, I mean, this is a book, this is like an old book that I love. I'm not 100% sure how many other people out there are gonna love it, you know, the same way I do. So I have a feeling when it's announced, everybody's going to be like, that's the book? He wants to write that? Why? You know, and I'll be like, hey, why? You know,
that's great.
But I guess the thing they can take comfort in is that obviously I'm doing this book out of love, you know, not out of a paycheck or any other reason. I do it because I really, really like it. And I've been chasing this book for years.
Interesting.
That's actually a kind of a, not much of a clue, but it's a clue that my entire 14, 13 years in comics, I've wanted to write this book.
Very interesting.
And again, when it's announced, I'm going to be like, all right, you know, whatever. You know, but hey, you know, I'm putting as much into it as I put into any of my own books.
Man, all right. Well, and you don't have to respond to this, but really, Sugar and Spike need to just stay where they are and don't need your help. Thank you.
I actually was one of the millions of people that pitched an Inferior Five reboot.
Very cool.
It was turned down. I thought I was the only one at the time, but then the editor at the time I was pitching it to at DC was like, you know, like everybody and their mother has pitched this.
Dumb bunny, man.
Yeah, I know.
Come on.
No, like who doesn't want to write?
Hell yeah. He wants to know about the next step after Local. What is the next 12-issue series?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's actually a really good question. I do have an idea that is really just an idea in my head. I mean, we're doing demo now, so that's kind of scratching that itch.
That, sure.
That format itch I have. I have something that I feel like I have to do with Oni again, because they did such a great job with Local. So I don't know when that's going to happen, but I really love that 12-issue standalone thing way too much to not do it. So, I have an idea for it. So,
And he wants to know when the New York 4 follow-up is coming?
I don't know actually how much I should say about that.
Okay.
Obviously, Minx is no more. So we had all signed contracts to do Volume 2 of that already while Minx was still around. And so now that Minx is gone, we actually realized that we were no longer bound by any of those four format rules.
Okay.
Like, it didn't have to be like a digest book. It didn't have to be that length. It didn't even have to be in black and white, you know. So we're talking about it, and it's gonna be a Vertigo book now. I'm not going to make it like, I mean, I'm sure because it's a Vertigo book, it's going to have a mature readers tag on it because they all do.
Okay.
It's not going to be any more mature than Local. I think it's probably going to turn to something that's a lot like Local in style-wise.
Cool.
And so we're, like, redoing all the contracts for that. But, you know, Ryan Kelly is drawing three issues of DMZ now. He's like, halfway through that short run. And after that, he's beginning the New York 4. So we're definitely putting it into production, like, by the summer. And I guess we'll just see how long it takes us.
You're known to be a writer very critical of what you write and seem to be in process of always adding a notch and improving your style from project to project. Which of your works, pre-DMZ, demo, supermarket, and local, are you most proud of? So I guess the early stuff. And he also wants to take away Channel Zero.
Okay. Take it away, you mean?
So in other words, outside of those, what of the early stuff, I guess, were you most proud of?
Local is my all-time favorite. That was actually, that launched the same month as DMZ, so I don't know if that qualifies.
Well, not. I guess he wants something other than those.
Oh.
I think he wants the really early stuff. But not Channel Zero, so he wants...
But there really isn't a whole lot left in there.
Well, the Couriers and Couscous Express.
Yeah, Couriers, Couscous Express, Pounded is in there.
Pounded, yeah.
Life for Tomorrow is in there. My Generation X run is in there.
That's of course,
no
yes.
One ever knows,
shame on me.
Knows about. Most proud of. That's actually a real tough one because I am pretty hard on myself. I would say it's a toss up, and this is an odd choice. It's a toss up between those last few issues of Generation X, which I'm sure are not good, but I like them a lot. I really feel like that they're like the unofficial prequel to Demo. There are these four single issues I did, issues 71 to 74, I think, where it was kind of like everything took place in the same day, but I just like focused on the individual kids, like what each one did was its own issue.
Interesting.
They didn't put those into the trade, into that Counter X trade. So good luck finding them. But I mean, I don't even have copies of them myself. I always look back fondly on those four. Out of the 14 issues or whatever I wrote, or I partially wrote, those four I really liked. I guess after that it'd be the Couriers. I guess I really feel like it was so much fun to do. I was a bike messenger for a part of the time, even though it's obviously crazily fictionalized, that book.
Sure.
It was still kind of fun to be able to, like, tap into that. And I would say, like, volumes one and volume three are my two favorites. And those are actually the two books they're putting together for the film.
Oh, okay.
They're combining those two stories.
Very cool.
Yep.
And he just wants you to know he loves all your work, but especially DMZ, Demo, and Local, and keep up the fantastic work.
Cool. Thank you.
BCD from Long Island. I find myself lately desiring more comics to read that don't feature grown men and women in fetish suits who are punching, kicking, shooting, or stabbing one another. Not that those things aren't delightful, but every now and then one needs a break.
Well, that's kind of what North Atlanters is, isn't it? Fetish suits, fur and leather, chain.
This is the real golden age, man.
You're right.
But so what non-superhero books? Yeah, well, and obviously BCD, I would say, pretty much all of Brian's books would be what I would recommend. But do you have any non-superhero fare that you're reading that you would recommend to BCD?
I mean, everybody and their mother will tell you that Scalped is one of the best books out there. It, like, makes me cry every time I read it.
Sure.
Because Jason just makes it look super easy. He's like such a laid-back guy.
Yes, he is.
One gets the impression that he just sort of like sits down and has a beer, and like the stories just like fall out of him. like he actually doesn't break a sweat. Drives me insane. That always gets my top recommendation right there. The unfortunately canceled Young Liars.
Yes, David Laffin.
Was a super, super excellent book.
That doesn't surprise me. You're a David Laffin fan, because so am I. It's Straight Bullets and all of it. Yeah, very cool dude.
That actually broke my heart. That book is almost done.
Yeah.
Not to sound like I'm just like, favoring the Vertigo home team, but, Scalped, Young Liars, I like Air a lot.
Oh, cool. Do you want to listen? Sure.
I'm actually not up to date on that, but I like it up to that first trade. Other than that, what else do I read? I read a lot of manga, actually.
Really?
I'm reading Gantz, which is a Dark Horse published book, which is like really, really gruesome and insane, which is kind of what manga does best, I think. I'm reading that and 20th Century Boys. Reading those. Let's see. Even though it's not out yet, I mean, if someone wants it, even though it's, I guess, technically a fetish suit, Garth's Punisher Max run.
Absolutely.
I always recommend, like, without hesitation. I only wish I was finding that book now, because it's, eight or nine volumes of it, and they're all really, really great.
I know. I trained myself to wait for the trade, and it was like every two, every 6 months, I'd have a new Punisher novel to read, and it was great, and I really did.
That was the only book I read both. I bought both the monthlies and the trades.
Wow.
Because I really just couldn't wait. So. Yep.
That's cool.
I actually read a lot of comics, which is, I don't really know why that is. I hear that's kind of a common thing. among writers and artists of comics.
I can appreciate that. I mean, you want to kind of keep your thoughts. All right, is that the fear? I'm just supposing.
I find myself like paying too much attention to the stuff I'm not supposed to. Like I open up like scallops, and I'm like, wow, that who's this colorist? You know, and, like I'm not actually reading it. I'm just like,
yeah, you're looking at craft.
Right, yeah, and it's kind of hard to not think that way and just kind of enjoy it, for what it is. You know, it's like knowing how hot dogs are made. You know,
I understand.
Magic is gone.
And I also wanted to ask, although it sounds like you were appreciative of the stories themselves as well, but when you were first discovering Miller and those guys, was it half craft and half entertainment? I mean, how would you dissect it?
It was pretty much pure entertainment at that point.
Okay.
I mean, I was in art school, and I was a painter. And it wasn't until, I think, like my final year where I began to draw comics. But up until then, I was reading comics, and it was kind of both. And I think I was like drawn to like those writer artist teams, like that Elektra Lives Again.
That's yes.
Where I plagiarized from that a couple times for homework assignments. Peter Bag Again. I mean, I could appreciate like one person, doing everything. Like a lot of like the fanographic indie books I read were like that. And I think it wasn't until I remember when I began to like trying to draw comics and trying to draw in black and white, which is something I'd never done. I mean, I was a painter, and I was shocked at how hard it actually was. Then I began to really kind of take books apart.
Interesting.
And actually, I have a J.P. Leon doing DMZ covers, and I remember picking up a Wolverine book he did, probably in '95, and loving his art. And I'm sure I'm making him feel very old by saying this, but I took that book apart. I mean, I studied that thing inside and out, trying to figure out how that guy drew.
Interesting.
And I'm sure he was in it. Influence too. I remember I think I actually probably took the book physically apart, I was like drawing over it, and like experimenting and stuff.
That's really cool.
I tell him that now and he just looks really, really embarrassed.
He really is amazing. And I'm glad they finally finished Winterman.
Worth
the wait though.
I feel like I'm going to go on like a tri-state killing spree if they don't put that out in a trade.
Hear. Well, I hope they will. I imagine they will because
it
really is a beautiful story.
Too. I mean, it's really. I mean, everybody wants it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what. I mean, I don't know if there's any behind the scenes stuff I don't know about, but I can't imagine why they wouldn't be, hurrying that to press.
Hey, how often do you, and you mentioned Jason Aaron, but like I always think you, Azzarello, Jason. Such interesting, unique voices, yet you guys, in this shared universe of Vertigo and everything are really...
bald?
You guys are all touching the same vibe, but in different ways, Well, and you're bald, too, but...
Yeah. that's the joke, right? How to make it in comics is to be bald and change your name to Brian.
No, but you're like...
Azzarello was like a this sounds really, really bad. He was like an idol of mine. And I don't mean that in like I'm fawning over him, although I'm sure I kind of was in some way. But I remember looking at just how his career was. And I remember thinking early on, like, that's what I want. This was like earlier on when he was like, I think 100 Bullets was underway. But he was kind of doing like a lot of stuff. Like I saw him over at Marvel doing stuff, doing like Cage and Banner,
mm-hmm.
and he was doing like Batman Broken City, with like 100 Bullets as like this like rock steady, like line, and he was kind of like he'd like follow that path, but then like bounce off and do other stuff. And I remember thinking like everything he did was like super cool. And like that's the kind of career I want to have. I remember kind of like zeroing in on that pretty early on. And it's like really kind of weirdly humbling now to be like sitting next to him at a panel, we don't talk a lot because we're both quiet guys, and I think we both, do our thing on our own. But when we do talk, it's always like really, really nice. I like him a lot.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Oren Lupin. I have to say that I love DMZ. It's the reason why I now read non-DC and Marvel stories. Does DMZ have a set story in mind, like 100 Bullets, or do you see it going on for a long time?
No, it's definitely... it was always meant to be sort of like, vaguely standard Vertigo length of like 66 to 70-ish issues.
Okay.
Preacher or Transmet. Right now, it's sort of like once I reach that halfway point, around like issue 35, I said, okay, now I got to actually plot this out to like the end. I had been keeping the end kind of vague because it's a book that really, it's a book that pulls a lot from what's happening in the world. So
no
I don't
question. Want to
lock myself into anything. So I always kept it pretty flexible. But I said now I actually have to have like an end point in view. So I think it's going to be 70-ish issues. What I really, really, really want to do is to do a couple of spin-offs while the main book is happening still. So I got a couple years left. I just want to do a couple of mini series on the side. Because DMZ is such a big world. It's such a huge concept that I see now that I'm never going to be able to get to everything I want to do. And I also recognize that book can't go on indefinitely. You know?
Sure.
So I have a couple ideas for like non-Maddie DMZ stories, which I'm currently talking to Vertigo now about doing. But other than that, it's going to be a 70-issue series.
And you flirted with some of these other characters earlier in those single one-shot stories, and even the current issue.
Yeah, they're all coming back. I keep going back to that issue 12, which was that issue that I drew that was like a magazine. I keep going back there and pulling names and characters out of that.
Excellent.
Which is a lot of fun, and I keep reusing other ones, even if only for like a second, one thing I will give away with the upcoming arc, actually, well, no, Ryan has his three-issue arc coming up, Ryan Kelly.
Does that start with 42?
That starts with 42.
Okay.
And then with 45, Ricardo's back with, like, the continuation of the Maddie Parco thing.
Excellent.
And I'm actually bringing, if you all go all the way back to DMZ 2, there's that sniper in the water tower who's now going to come back and be, like, a pretty big character in the book.
Very cool.
So it's fun. It's fun just to go back and do that,
Excellent. I before we started rolling, I told Brian that I do want to have a moment to focus on DMZ, and depending on how the questions go, because we're at an hour now, Brian, and I don't want to overtax you. Okay. Well, I appreciate that.
I'll let you know if my anything happens.
All right. Or if you get bored,
I fall down dead or anything.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, we are going to cover DMZ a lot longer. And I might have time for one DMZ question because, yeah, I just want to say how much I'm enjoying it. And as I told Brian, it frightens me how the real world is getting closer to this not-so-distant future world of DMZ. And I think the drop in newspapers is really what struck a chord with me. And I couldn't help but think of Maddie and how he, the citizen journalism is only propagating more and more as the decline of these news bureaus all around the world happen and everything, so...
I don't really know if that's a good thing or not.
I'm scared.
I'm kind of in denial about what everybody says is the death of print, and I kind of like always argue with friends. No, it's not dying. It's not going to die. I don't really know. I mean, it took me years and years of writing Maddie before my subconscious finally let me know that the whole Maddie thing. Is like he's like a blogger. I mean, he is
yes.
like the blogosphere. It took me forever before it finally dawned on me that's what I was doing all this time. It's kind of funny how that worked. With all the flaws. I mean, not to diss on bloggers, but I mean, they're not, I mean, they're like independent guys out there kind of like doing their own thing. And that's exactly what he does, you know, and he does great things and he like, you know, messes up and kind of like, you know, sort of like it's all, everything's on the fly. You know, and he's like kind of battling against like the media giant.
Yeah. No, I love it. And all right, we're gonna explore this more in a future conversation. But I love the shift of where the story is now, with issue 40.
Well, that's good. I mean, the next year of DMZ or whatever, we're on, what are we on? 42 is coming out in a couple weeks. 49 is going to be the giant, like
shift,
crazy cliffhanger of the series.
Interesting.
Issue 50 is gonna be a special-ish issue. We're still working out in what way. But, yeah, this is like, I mean, I kind of call it like the rise and fall of Maddie. I've been calling that in interviews a few times.
That'll be issue 50.
I mean, everybody knows his crash is coming. That's issue 40, 49.
Okay.
And then from 51 to the end, you know, it's like the fallout of that.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, we should talk at some point in the next half a year or whatever.
Okay, very good. No, I hope to because, yeah, it's, like I say, I can't help but look at the real world. And the only other guy that I can think of that was like that, and it was even a smaller event, was when Rucka was writing Queen of Country.
Yeah.
And you know, I felt the same kind of thing where, you know, you guys kind of stumble on putting variables together. And then, you know, life imitates art, and that's just
crazy.
Yeah,
it's not really anything I think we're particularly happy about.
Well, no.
it's not the kind of thing where I like to be proven right. I mean, really, like with DMZ, I don't know if this is what Greg does or what anybody else does, but I just sort of take what's happening now and just, like, extrapolate it out a couple of steps. Like, I think of, like, the worst-case scenario, you know, and it's really depressing when, you know, when that worst case scenario is what happens, you know?
Yeah. No, I understand.
It makes for a very pessimistic worldview. I mean, I argue with a friend of mine who's always saying I'm so negative, and I'm saying it's my job to be negative. I have to wake up every day and, like, punching a clock. I have to, like, think of, like, really negative stuff for this book, you know? Like, after I punch out, then I can start, you know, thinking hopefully about the future, but not while I'm writing DMZ. So, depressing.
Dave, 0923. Mr. Wood, Demo is one of my favorite books in my collection. It's probably on my list of my top 10 favorite books of all time. You and Becky Cloonan make that book a beautiful work of art, the way you got deep into every character and made them feel like real three-dimensional people. And Becky's different but all fantastic styles made everything so powerful. It was beautiful. My question is, what is one of your favorite stories in the collection, and where did it come from? My personal favorite is Stand Strong.
Yeah, that one's definitely... it's funny because Becky and I both have the same favorite issues, which is cool. Number four is definitely one. I really feel like that's kind of like more Becky's story than mine. Like I think she said it in the town she was living in at the time. I mean, I was just kind of writing a kind of like my take on like this super strong dude, and like a bit. I mean, some is like the generational stuff. You know, I could relate to like expectations of family, and kind of being like stuck in like a small town. Like I could relate to that on some level, but. I mean, I really feel like I think Becky may have put a bunch of her friends into that issue. So that one is a big one. Number eight, the mixtape one.
Okay. Yeah.
That's probably my favorite one.
I remember that one. That was a good one.
Yeah, that actually weirdly that was like cannibalized from a Channel Zero idea I had ages ago and never did. Not, I mean, obviously not the same way, but the notion of, you know, like someone's suicide and like kind of like walking through, you know, the cause and effect of it, like kind of after the fact. And I kind of, one of my favorite things about that, and kind of what I tried to do with demo overall, is make the stories interpretable in a couple of different ways. I mean, so I've never said what my point was, but in that story, some people say, oh, the girl's a ghost, you know, and he's talking to her. People's like, well, there is no girl now because she's dead. There is no ghost. He's just like talking in his own head.
Sure.
And then some people are like, no, her voice is actually on the tape he's listening to, because he listens to like the tape the entire the story, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it, I mean, I think a lot of it was like, you know, I mean, I was kind of hoping that's what would happen. I mean, that book was really me like finding my feet as a writer. And that issue, I felt like, worked out really, really well. So I always really like the fact that everybody kind of seems to have a different take on it. Becky and I both really like 11, which is kind of that goofier one set in the supermarket. I really think that after 11 issues of that book, which was like, I mean, we were doing it at like a small press. We weren't getting paid a dime. I mean, I think Becky was getting some like nominal amount for the covers, or just some like upfront fee, but the book hadn't begun to make any money at that point. And especially for Becky, who spent like a year of her life, you know, working full time on it. Like, I was just like, let's just like do some kind of dumb, just kind of have fun. And I'm like, I told her, I didn't care how you draw it, just have fun and fun with it. So it really has like this light feel. And I had fun writing it. I don't write a lot of stuff where I'm trying to be funny. That's one of the few ones. So that's a favorite of ours, not so much because of the story itself, but just because of, like, you know, how we did it and why and when. It was like a blowing off steam issue, and we both really, really look back fondly on that.
To Cheesy. Mr. Wood, what type of research materials, if any, go into DMZ? Are there any published references you'd like to share?
Yeah, well, I over-research a lot. All I pretty much do is read books. That's my research, is reading books. Once in a while, I'll watch documentaries like the Northlanders.
Sure.
The Generation Kill book, the original book that they made into the HBO show.
Yes.
That was a pretty useful book in language, like language of troops. Because it was all, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was all recorded and transcribed. And it was actually pretty different than what I thought it would be. There wasn't a lot of, like, there's a lot less jargon than I think is the stereotype of how soldiers talk. It just felt very, very real, and it felt very modern. It felt very, like, you know, for lack of a better term, like MTV generation. It was very much like, you know, of the right now, you know. There's a lot of like references in there to music and pop culture stuff, which wasn't anything I really expected to find in a book like that. So that book I read a lot and kept referring back to. I read a lot of books, obviously about. I mean, there's like an overabundance of books from embedded journalists in the first Gulf War. And I read a few of those, but also I really went back and read books about, like, wars from, like, decades ago. I read, like, a lot of, like, you know, like, Serbian Bosnian accounts.
Okay.
And actually a lot of books, there were a lot of books written, Soviet books, about the Afghanistan invasion, which are just, like, unbelievable. Like, horrible, horrible accounts of like the worst kind of war imaginable. That actually, I think I may have found the most helpful. Just kind of getting like that bleakness that DMZ often has, and that sort of, I think from like the Russian point of view, they're not trying to like make a point so much. It's sort of like, this is what happened. Boom, and now I'm done. and I'm done talking about it. You know, make up your own mind.
Interesting.
It was really sort of like blunt, like that. And I feel like, you know, American accounts, they always try to, like, you know, it's either being spun one way or the other. You know, like,
yeah, it's either, you know, jingoism, well, or it's
like war's tough, but, you know, we got to do that kind of thing, or like war sucks. Like, we should never have invaded in the first. Like, there's always like some kind of like a point to be made.
Sure.
But in these Russian books, they were just like, you know, I feel like the point was like a foregone conclusion. Like, this war is like the worst thing in the world, you know? And so it was kind of like nice to be able to get an account of war that wasn't part of an agenda.
That's cool. I always tell, I'm Greek, and I always tell my younger cousins that are shocked at what they see with what happened in Iraq, and I always point to our own home country of Greece and say, you know, we went through kind of the same stuff 50 years ago, and I didn't realize until I started reading about the Greek Civil War and everything that happened post-World War II leading up to really the 70s.
Yeah.
And just, you know, yeah, how crazy it was. And
I actually know nothing about that.
No worries, man.
No, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I feel like I should, you know.
Well, it's another, I mean, it's, in a lot of ways, there are echoes, yeah, of what are things that are happening in Pakistan and Afghanistan and certainly,
right,
in Iraq. And I think, and I read you've also taken stock of what happened in Katrina and weaved it into.
Yeah, yeah.
DMZ as,
yeah,
well.
Not as much as I really felt like I should have. DMZ is a difficult book to write. I really feel like I never ever have enough room. It's a constant frustration, and I really feel like I was able to, I really wish I was able to have talked about that more than I did.
I almost wonder if some of the events that happen overwhelm you. To the point where you go, oh, no, that's good. Oh, that's good, too, and that you're constantly making...
Yeah, I definitely have more ideas than I feel like I can use. And definitely the longer the book runs, I feel like it's, like, harder to introduce new things. Like, the Maddie story just keeps getting bigger and bigger, you know?
Sure.
And it's kind of the reason why I want to do all, like these spin-offs. You know, because I have ideas, and I cannot put them into the main story. You know, try as I might.
Let's see. As a writer of a Viking comic series, who is your pick to play Thor in the upcoming film adaptation?
Well, I don't know. I kind of wish this guy would be in my Viking movie, but Viggo Mortensen, I think, is the obvious choice.
He needs to just be
in any Viking movie. He actually writes a lot of like Scandinavian and Icelandic poetry.
Really?
Yep. My wife saw him read from a poetry book years ago at some bookstore, and I went online and you can find them all there.
That's cool. That's like, yeah, Robert Shaw. You know, that's like discovering that, oh yeah, Robert Shaw's an author. Not only was he a great actor, but
right. Yeah, it's cool. So I mean, I just think. I mean, I would like crawl through broken glass to get him to play Sven.
That's cool.
In a Northlanders film, but if he's Thor, it's cool too. It's all good as long as he's the Viking.
And finally, Zach Goyet asks, I was hoping you could talk about your Counter X Generation X work with Warren Ellis a little. I enjoyed your run and was wondering what your thoughts were on it. Would you ever go back to Marvel, or are you staying in the creator-owned arena?
Well, I'm definitely. I mean. I don't know. I mean, I, you know, given the choice, I'll always pick a creator-owned book. I mean, there are a few times. I mean, I've definitely pitched a lot of like company books. Mm-hmm. You know, like Inferior Five, of course, like I said, and other things that haven't been possible. My brain just doesn't always think that way. Like I said, I didn't grow up with these books. I actually kind of find them a bit intimidating. All the history involved, you know. So it's not really what I choose. As far as Marvel goes, when did I finish Generation X? 2000, I think, possibly 2001, and they've never called me since.
Okay.
I don't quite know why. I mean, I don't know. So and. like I kind of don't even know what I would write there, and I'm sure they have no use for me. They have their pick of writers, so I very much doubt I would ever do Marvel stuff, at least like you know in the foreseeable future. Okay. I did really enjoy that book. I actually had read that book, Gen Generation X, at the beginning, because I think I just finished. I think I just found Chris's Death book, his Vertigo book, Death, and so I saw he was drawing Generation X at the beginning, so I picked it up and liked it a lot. And I had fun with that book. It was definitely it's something I don't recall writing. Like I kind of open up the book now, and I'm like, I have no recollection of writing these words, yeah. Which is kind of a funny feeling.
Yeah.
But it was great to work with Warren. I mean, Warren taught me how to write a comic book script. I mean, there's no, I mean, he was the one and the only one that taught me that. So it was incredibly valuable, in that way. And it was just also like a lot of fun. I mean, at the beginning, he would send me something that was almost a finished script, and said, "Here you go, you know, just like put the dialogue into your words." You know, so I was able to like look at basically almost a complete Warren Ellis script and see how he did it. And as the issues went on, he did less and less, so it kind of weaned me into it. And so I think by the time like he had written, I think he wrote, he actually wrote script for like the first four issues, and then for like the next four, he would just give me like a page worth of notes. You know, and then I wrote all those scripts there off of his story notes.
I see.
And then for like the last, I think, five, I just did it all on my own. It was fun. It was, like I said, I mean, I look back fondly on it, especially those last few. But that kind of like Young Mutant thing is what, I mean, it's what Demo is. I mean, Demo is my version of that, you know?
Sure.
So I feel like I've kind of gotten out of my system, or if I haven't, I can just write more Demo. I don't feel like I have to go to Marvel for it.
What is there an aspect of comic book writing in particular that didn't occur to you that Warren taught you, or was it just really the whole
I knew nothing. Roadmap? I knew absolutely nothing. There was never a Channel Zero script. I never wrote a script for that book. I mean, I drew it first, and then I kind of wrote it afterwards. Like,
okay.
I knew what the story was in my head, and I had absolutely no idea how to write a script. I mean, I knew it wasn't like a movie script. I mean, I could find a movie script online, but I really couldn't find a comic book script online at that time. So I still write scripts the same way Warren does. Every so often, he'll post up a script online, you know, a recent script, and I'll read it, and I'm like, yeah, you know, he and I write the same way, like the same kind of breaks and format stuff and everything. It's funny.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, hey, man, I will wrap up and say okay. Again and point everybody to jump onto Northlander 17 because it is a really neat story. And
I know everybody says, hey, buy my book, but, I mean, I really mean it this time. If you know, of everything that's coming out, if you're only going to read one, that's the one to read.
Well, and it really, it's a good sample of the universe and the kind of stories that you'll find. And it's good action. It's, again, very straightforward, and people shouldn't be intimidated if they are about the period because it is a very contemporary story taking place in the year 1000 or, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
give or take.
Well, then, and that's the that's the fun of it. And good luck, man. It's I'm glad that there are creators like you because you do. You have a very unique voice, and I'm glad that you have found the platform to tell the stories that you want to tell. Because
I feel very, very blessed. I mean, I was poor for a very long time, and I worked at it for a very long time. Like comics did not pay any of my bills for a good like 7 or 8 years, but. I mean, so I feel, I mean, I'm, like, happy that I put in that work and I built up, like a creator-owned kind of a career, but I also feel very, very fortunate, and obviously I had help from a lot of other writers and artists and retailers and everybody that doggedly kept buying my books, even when they're hard to find, so I really appreciate it, everybody.
Well, continued success, and we will talk again and get in-depth on DMZ.
Yeah,
because
that'd be very cool.
That's Brian Wood. Don't forget, Northlander 17 is out Thursday, tomorrow. Make sure you go to your local store, pick it up. If it's not there, make sure you order it. This is a great chance to jump in on a great series from a very unique voice in the comic business, Brian Wood. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where you'll find a wide variety of original graphic novels, trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials, all at savings of up to 35% off the cover price, with orders of $50 or more receiving free shipping. Featured at InStockTrades.com, you can find plenty of books with the name Brian Wood on the cover. How about Supermarket, the trade paperback? The standard retail price for Supermarket is $14.99 at InStockTrades.com, just $10.49. What about Volume 1 of Northlanders or Volume 1 of DMC? Both retail for $9.99 at InStockTrades.com. You can receive each of them for just $6.29. How about the hardcover edition of Local from Oni Press? A great collection of 12 issues between Brian and Ryan Kelly. The standard retail price, $29.99. At InStockTrades.com, just $20.99. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com. For all your pre-order monthly needs, you can track your orders online. There are monthly specials up to 75% off. And don't forget, you get savings of 40% off the major publishers. For all the details, check out the websites, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget, look for Word Balloon all over the internet and our archive of well over 200 interviews with creators. Great stories right from the creator's mouth. You only get that from Word Balloon on a weekly basis, and we're happy to provide you with the service. You can find us at iTunes, at Newsarama, at our website, wordballoon.com, which also features our message board and forum where we discuss the episodes, and sometimes we'll post a thread as well for questions, offering you and the Peanut Gallery the chance to ask some of these questions yourself that you might not get a chance to do at a convention. You can also reach me if you have any questions or comments about the show at the message board at wordballoon.com, or you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Twitter. John Wordballoon is my handle there. You can find me on Facebook as well. And I'm there for all your questions and comments. Until next time, thanks again for listening. More great shows on the way. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2009.